You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. We'll continue now to look at the resignation of Harvard President Claudine Gay, its aftermath, its implications. Gay, the university's first Black and second woman president, resigned after a public pressure campaign against her amid allegations of plagiarism and failure to respond sufficiently to anti-Semitism on campus. But to be clear, this isn't just about Harvard. What happens seems to lay at this intersection of several fronts: Congress, higher education, efforts towards diversity, equity, and inclusion, and fundamentally, how all of us learn and express our opinions. So with us now, Renee Landers, a professor of law and faculty director at Suffolk University Law School, also a former member of the Harvard Board of Overseers, and Cornell William Brooks, professor of public leadership and social justice at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's also a civil rights attorney and former NAACP president. Also still with us, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin here in Studio 2. Renee, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I appreciate you joining us. And Cornell, welcome to you as well.
It's good to be with all of you. Thank you.
So I am just going to start with your reactions to the news over the last 24 hours. Renee Landers, we'll have you go first.
Well, I think it's a very disappointing and sad situation. I think the use of the word sad in both Claudine Gay's resignation statement and in the corporation's statement about her resignation was probably appropriate. I think it's sad for the institution and sad for her that she personally and the institution have become such flashpoints in a much larger culture war that's going on about higher education. I think one of the I think that Harvard is probably well advised to, take some time to kind of let some of these issues and some of the controversy settle down a little bit. I think one of your previous guests, the Harvard Crimson editor, she noted that it doesn't actually, that her resignation, Claudine Gay's resignation, doesn't really solve any of the underlying issues, but at least it will, take that personality issue for at least the short term out of the situation. The last thing I want to say is that I think that this is a larger issue that goes even beyond higher education, because I think we've been living in a world in recent years where every organization, corporation, employer feels pressure from their constituencies to take positions on important external issues, and some of these organizations are really not well positioned to actually have an opinion because they don't know about the issues. They're not expert in it. And I think universities have to tread a very fine line here because they need to make sure that the environment is open for continuing debate and discussion about these controversial issues. So I think one of my hopes is that as a society, now that we've been through this phase, that we could perhaps take a step back and that the expectation that every organization on every issue has to make some kind of public statement, that just seems to be an unreasonable expectation to me.
So Cornell Brooks, I'll have you pick it up from there, please. And feel free to either react to the news, build on what you heard from Renee. I will tell you one of the questions on my mind is whether you were surprised. So if you want to address that part of it too, feel free.
Certainly. So let me just start by saying that as a member of the Harvard community, as a member of the faculty, as a professor, as someone who cares deeply about students and their well-being, and certainly as a citizen of this country, I am incredibly distressed and disturbed by Claudine Gay's resignation, more so in terms of what led to it. In several respects. First and foremost, where we have students in the wake of October 7th and the attack by Hamas who had sincere and legitimate concerns about their safety and well-being, given what they were seeing on their phones in terms of terrorism. and then certainly all the carnage in the aftermath of that. So where we have students who are concerned about their well-being, a rise in anti-Semitism, and I might note as a former president of an organization founded by Blacks and Jews, the NAACP, a rise in other forms of hate. So in the wake of all of that, we begin with a conversation about the safety and well-being of students and the well-being of speech on college campuses. And we are now in this discourse and discussion about literally the racial and gender weaponization of those concerns and the demise, the political decapitation, if you will, of Harvard in terms of losing its president. Very, very, very distressing. I'm also disturbed and concerned about the fact that this is not merely about an attack on diversity at an elite institution. It is also about the racial profiling and employment among the rank and file Black folks and women in this country. So in other words, it's not merely about diversity up top, but that trickle-down discrimination that comes from the assumptions that women can never be qualified. People can never be qualified.
I'm not sure that's I understand the connection there, and I'm not pushing back. I just need you to connect those dots more clearly, please, Cornell Brooks.
Of course. So where the opponents of Claudine Gay, literally from the beginning, as you put it, from the get, go after her as a woman, as a person of African descent, as a Black person, as the first Black president of Harvard. They go after her because of that. They characterize her as an affirmative action baby, as a diversity hire, and they attach any perceived failings or flaws or mistakes to her being Black and her being a woman, okay? And from that, where we see her resignation literally being driven by racial animus in part, right? Because we note the Harvard Corporation's letter, we note her letter noting the fact that race played a part in all of this. Now, when we get down to get away from Harvard and get down to the level of people applying for jobs, the same set of assumptions about women, the same set of assumptions about Black people influence hiring decisions, firing decisions, resignations, terminations, not merely at Harvard, but also among rank and file people who are applying for jobs, including folks who are going to be graduating from Harvard and entering the job market. This is real.
Yeah.
It can't be denied.
That was helpful. Thank you. So here's where we are. We're speaking with Cornell Brooks at the Harvard Kennedy School and Renee Landers at Suffolk Law, both professors. We have Max Larkin, who's an education reporter here at WBUR here in Studio 2. We are now breaking down the implications and looking at the implications of the resignation of Harvard University President Claudine Gay yesterday. What I want to do is bring you back in here, Max, for both reactions to what we've heard from Renee and Cornell and context that you might want to add. And then we're gonna sort of step back from that after a quick break. But let me give you a chance to do that first.
Yeah, I mean, insofar as I was covering Harvard before all this started, it was generally to do with the Supreme Court's consequential decision last year about affirmative action and what they call race-conscious admissions. This is a school that I think justifiably could be said to be sort of a WASP bastion for most of its history and only slowly comes to incorporate other cohorts from American life, right? And most recently, that has translated into a pretty marked uptick in Black and Latino representation on the campus. So you have, in a sense, a demographic pivot. Then you announce your next leader, the daughter of Haitian immigrants, a woman who paid her dues and was going to take over. And so the lurch from that hopeful story to the Supreme Court striking down race-conscious admissions, and now the first Black president lasting only 6 months in the job is kind of extraordinary. I spoke to Jaime Sanchez Jr., who is a historian of identity politics, and he's a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows, and he kind of commented on that whiplash.
There was a lot of hope and inspiration derived from just her being there, right? She represented a lot of people's aspirations. So to see where, you know, we are now and her kind of abrupt resignation is startling.
Startling there being kind of an understatement, I think, Tiziana. So when Cornell was saying earlier that this kind of, you feel a deep ripple of pain on social media, on people you talk to, particularly among Black women who say, you know, basically they can get rid of the president of Harvard, they can get rid of anyone.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, still with us in our conversation at the impacts and aftermath of the resignation of Harvard President Claudine Gay yesterday. Renee Landers, a professor of law and faculty director at Suffolk University Law School, also a former member of the Harvard Board of Overseers. Cornell William Brooks, professor of public leadership and social justice at the Harvard Kennedy School and a former NAACP president, and WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. I want to bring us to implications now that we've sort of had reactions, context. We actually also spoke earlier in the hour with a student at Harvard who was also a reporter at the Harvard Crimson. And Renee Landers, I'm going to pick it up. One of the things that struck me in what you said in your reactions to the news, you referred to a flashpoint in, quote, the culture war going on in education, end quote. And that struck me because in October and early November, it looked like what we were looking at was a flashpoint in what was happening in a war in the Middle East and the cultural tensions here in the United States and here on campuses in Boston around that. And when the plagiarism accusations came forward, we wound up in a new space, and we know that that was being pushed, and I've laid out here on the show direct quotes about how that was being pushed by conservatives. I want to ask about who decides. Both of you, you and Cornell, have laid out this was outside pressure. There's been a lot of dismay about that. Are you troubled, I think you said you were, by this outside pressure leading to the resignation of a university president? Cornell referred to it as a decapitation of the university. Who should decide, and what's been problematic in that for you, Renee Landers?
Well, I think I want to put this, what's happened at Harvard, in the context of what's happened with the other universities that we were talking about today, the resignation of the Penn president, and then, you know, possible ramifications for, you know, other college presidents around the country. And I think that anytime, you know, there's a very careful tight walk that these elite universities, any university has to, you know, tightrope walk that any university has to manage between acknowledging the views of their constituencies, donors, students, faculty, the public at large, and actually making independent decisions that are the best for the organization, regardless of what these other, particular constituencies might think. And I think the perception that the universities have been unduly influenced, or that they have caved to outside pressure in an effort just to make the issue go away, is a very dangerous, sets a very dangerous precedent for all of these schools. I think it will, finding leaders who are willing to kind of take the risk in that kind of environment will be increasingly challenging. And unless the governing boards of these institutions are, you know, really kind of try, you know, to reset the expectations about what kind of influence donors and other, outside constituencies can play in the actual decision making of the organization.
So Cornell Brooks, that it raises a really interesting question, right? Because on the one hand, as an outside observer, and I'll note, I have been on faculty of a university, not at Harvard, but I have been faculty, right? You want institutions to have daylight and be transparent and be accountable to all the kinds of organizations they might touch and serve. And universities have a broad reach. So one might think, good, lots of people have a stake in a university and accountability is good. On the other hand, one can totally imagine a leader saying, wait a minute, if anybody can pull on the levers, how on earth can I be successful if I can't even tell who I'm accountable to and who might have the influence on, you know, my job? How am I supposed to make hard decisions or do tough right. things or move us in new directions? How do you even crack that nut for Harvard now, especially since Harvard, while it is at one point in one way sort of often maligned as the ultimate in ivory tower, is also sort of a symbolic institution for all of higher education as one of the oldest, if not the oldest, institution of higher education. I think it is, Max, it's the oldest. Yeah,
the
I
oldest.
Think. Yeah. So Cornell.
Yes, yes. So I think it's important for us in order to defend, in order for Harvard to defend itself from threats to its academic integrity and its sense of itself, it's important to appreciate the measure of the threat and the source of the threat. And here's what I mean. So this is not about defending presidents from outside pressure. It's about Harvard defending itself in terms of what it is as an institution, its academic integrity, its well-being, its sense of being a leader, not only in terms of the global academy, but also a leader in public discourse. So what that means is that that means that we have to understand this moment as an existential threat. It's not about a few donors having too much power. It's not about donations having too much of an influence. It's a matter of understanding that this moment is a very serious moment and a moment in which we have to protect the college itself, protect the university itself, and first and foremost, of course, protect our students. What does that mean? It means that we engage in a period of serious self-examination. It means that we focus on the importance of leadership. And by leadership, it means not merely the ability to withstand political pressure. It's also a matter of what values you assert with respect to the world. So in other words, it's not merely a matter of whether or not your papers and articles are properly cited. It's also a matter of whether we have a full and robust debate on campus. It's also a matter of whether or not our students feel safe on campus. It's also a matter of whether or not we as an institution, Harvard as an institution, feels intellectually and morally self-confident enough to take a stand in the world and be willing to pay a price for having taken that stand.
Let me bring Max in here.
Yeah, I had a question sort of for Cornell. When Virginia Fox, the North Carolina Republican congresswoman who kicked off that hearing last month, she did this kind of commingling where she said anti-Semitism is related to DEI, which is related to the race-based ideology of the radical left. As a professor of social justice training future leaders, do you feel a chill in the air? Like, is there a sense that, you know, your work has in a certain sense become politicized as part and parcel of all this, right?
That's right. And I think this is a moment where we have to call out this kind of intellectual dishonesty and disingenuousness. If anti-Semitism is said to be the world's oldest hate, that would suggest that it predates the beginning of DEI. That is absolutely intellectually
DEI being diversity, equity, and inclusion. For
diversity,
listeners.
Equity, and inclusion, right? Anti-Semitism predates affirmative action.
By 2,000 years.
Right. So how can it be said, right? How can it be said that literally when, and I'm speaking as a civil rights leader as well as a professor, when the Tree of Life Synagogue was attacked, when Jews are beaten on the street, had their yarmulkes knocked off their heads. This is not about diversity, equity, and inclusion or affirmative action. This has everything to do with a long-standing hatred that must be addressed squarely and in a morally honest and intellectually frank manner.
I want to bring...
So she should have been called out for that, and Harvard cannot capitulate to an argument that on its face. There are no facts to support this. Like, in other words, look at the hate crime statistics.
So I'm sorry. I need to correct myself. Pittsburgh, not Connecticut. Thank you. And Cornell, you've made a strong point there, but I just don't want to lose Renee's voice in this too. So I'm going to ask you to take a pause. I want to take a chance to get Renee back in. We've only got a couple minutes left in the show. And Renee, I want to invite you to reflect on that. And if not that, then I want to ask you to help connect the dots even more clearly for us, for people. There will be some listeners who say, listen, my kid's never going to Harvard. In fact, Harvard locks out the majority of kids. And so how does this apply to me outside that institution?
So I think that you raise a good point about how the overemphasis on Harvard because of its prominence is not necessarily where the public attention should be focused. That, you know, the vast majority of young people in the United States do not attend elite institutions. A very tiny percentage of them do. Millions of college students attend other institutions. And the real threat I see here are things to academic freedom and to the ability of all people in the society to think that they have opportunities for higher education. Those threats are occurring significantly in other places. What's going on in Florida to attack, you know, what topics can be addressed. You can't talk about issues that might be upsetting to people. You cannot talk about the history of racism in the United States. All of these issues, or you cannot talk about LGBT gay and gay issues and those community issues. And all of these issues are being taken off the table. Those are the real threats to academic freedom. I'm not minimizing the need to kind of change some of the, you know, cultural discord that perhaps is going on at Harvard and other places, but those are the real threats to higher education. And the people who started and who were the proponents of the litigation to challenge affirmative action and the use of race in admissions, first of all, overemphasized the extent to which that was occurring, because again, in the vast majority of colleges and universities, they take many of the students that apply. And so therefore, race never is part of the conversation about the admissions process. And second, it's a long orchestrated campaign, as Cornell was alluding to really try to distort the constitutional amendments that were designed to really give new opportunities to people of color in the country, and to distort them and contort them into maintaining, you know, the kind of status quo of, you know, the historical white privilege that's existed in the United States. And I think that that is, and that part of what has happened at Harvard is a continuation of that effort.
So we'll say goodbye there for now. There's much more to talk about on this subject going forward. Renee Landers, Suffolk University Professor of Law there. Cornell Brooks, Harvard Kennedy School Professor of Public Leadership and Social Justice there. Max Larkin, WBUR Education Reporter. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.